The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. And good morning, everyone.
Morning.
The first case this morning is number 09-1058, Medtronic Navigation against Brain Lab. Mr. Wexler.
May it please the court. This is an exceptional case, not because of anything that Medtronic or its lawyers did during the trial or beforehand, but because of how exceptionally important it is that this court reverse the sanction award, which is not only entirely unwarranted on the facts and the law, but more fundamentally is inconsistent with an adversary system of justice in which each side is expected to present its case zealously, consistent with the contemporaneous rulings of the trial court.
But Mr. Waxman, here we have a district judge. There's a lot of over-litigation in this country, and the trial courts are in a position to deal with it, and we have an abuse of discretion standard. Here we had a claim construction of reference means, and Medtronic was seeking a claim construction that would have encompassed the accused optical device.
Correct.
And the claim construction was that it did not include optical device, it was just devices, it was just acoustic. And yet the trial court felt and gave a fair amount of explanation in its opinion that Medtronic just went right past that and misled the jury. The language of the judge's opinions includes distorting and blatantly deceiving the jury, misdirected. These words are throughout the opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't we just affirm that?
Several reasons. The first of which is that the judge's conclusion that arguing an equivalence case, which Medtronic fully disclosed at the summary judgment stage and through in its opening statement, throughout all the witness testimony, in its closing arguments, his conclusion that presenting an equivalence case in which we argued not that the claims literally covered optical devices,
they were arguing for a generic interpretation, and they pulled back. It was like, the claim construction pulled back. It was like file wrapper estoppel.
Well,
and then they went to argue again. Well, we want the same thing that the court just ruled we couldn't have.
Judge Lurie, we use the example in our footnote in our reply brief of a case in which the patent claim, the claim language, calls for a fastener, but the specification refers to a zipper. There is an argument at the Markman hearing. The judge concludes that because of the specification, the literal claim requires a zipper. It is garden variety doctrine of equivalence law to be able to come in a forthright, open manner and say, we intend to put on proof that a button or other form of fastening device meets the function way result test. After the claim construction in this case, Medtronic withdrew three of the patents as to which it was prosecuting. It announced to the court that as to Buchholz and Roberts, not Heilbrunn, which didn't involve this, but was preceded only by equivalence, there was full summary judgment briefing on this point with expert reports by experts who testified at trial precisely the same way that they testified on summary judgment. Judge Mache denied summary judgment.
There were some differences, I take it. Your position is that there was a simplification as opposed to a change of position, but the positions of the experts, I gather, were not entirely congruent between...
Well, Judge Bryson, with respect, we have to distinguish between the two equivalence patents, Buchholz and Roberts,
right,
and the two literal patents, which are the Heilbrunn patents.
Right. the Heilbrun patent.
As to the Heilbrun patents, and but as to the Heilbrun patents, even in his evulsive about-face post-trial ruling, Judge Mache has never contended that our case was vexatious or we engaged in litigation misconduct with respect to Heilbrun. Mm-hmm. The argument all goes to this notion that somehow proceeding on a theory of equivalence with respect to Buchholz and Roberts was vexatious or misconduct. As to Heilbrun, what happened was, there was a difference, and here's what it was. There was one element of the Heilbrun claim that had to do with the workspace calibration element. Our expert reports, and there are two different brain lab devices. One is the Vector Vision and one is ExactTrack. Our expert report by Dr. Taylor, Professor Taylor, gave two reasons why that limitation was met in each of the two devices. One referenced workspace calibration and the other referenced camera calibration. Mm-hmm. At trial, he proceeded with testimony and evidence relating to workspace calibration as to either. That is, we simplified our proof and relied on one argument and one demonstration for why that claim was literally met right. as to each of
the devices. That was my understanding. So okay. it's you characterize it as simplification. Your opposing counsel, I think, characterized it, if I recall correctly, as a change of position.
Well, we as to each of their two devices, we argued as to Heilbrun, this element. Our expert presented testimony as to two reasons why it was met. At trial, we presented only one. But I think Judge Lurie's, as to Buchholz and Roberts, that is the equivalence or non-equivalence of optical or passive optical to active acoustic and electromagnetic, this was fully and completely disclosed. We won on summary judgment. We won on not one, but two Rule 50A motions filed by BrainLab on this point exactly. We got a jury verdict on this point. And the notion that, and I think I'm finally winding my way around to your question, the notion that our manner of litigation was vexatious and that it distorted the court's claim construction is an error of law. This was, as any review of the record in this case will show, this was a garden variety doctrine of equivalence case as to which there was, you know, we lost in a Rule 50 motion and you affirmed. I recognize that. But we had a very credible case that was elusively disclosed about why we met the function. There wasn't even a contest as to either function or result. They agreed, the trial court agreed, that the function and the result of the optical sensors versus the acoustic and electromagnetic sensors was the same. A whole dispute was about the way. And we had an expert witness fully opine on this in his report.
Okay, but we appreciate we aren't reviewing the merits. Let me ask you what I find particularly troublesome. I can understand, and we'll save Mr. Phillips' time.
I don't want to be not neighborly. I promised I would sit down after 5 minutes, and I see it's 7 minutes.
I'm going to ask him the same question I'm about to ask you, and that is, I can appreciate in a lengthy trial that one can always find this or that to complain about, and when you pull the infractions or misstatements or whatever else together in one place, they look pretty bad. Now, this is an experienced judge who seems to have recognized that as he proceeded with the trial. But obviously, when it was all over, something very much bothered this judge. And this really relates to what Judge Lurie was asking as well. The judge was there. We weren't. And an experienced judge, after seeing all of these distinguished counsel in action, concludes that they went too far. Now, how can we penetrate that?
That's what's so very troubling about the consequence, even the prospect of an affirmance in this case, Judge Newman, because in this case, we have a very, very pellucid pretrial and trial record. We know how, as to each of the current assignments of litigation misconduct, We know exactly what happened and exactly what the judge did. And if I can, I mean, the judge's litigation misconduct conclusion is predicated on four principles. And I can go quickly through the four of them or defer to Mr. Phillips.
See them. They're
So they're
stressed by your opponents.
Sure. I'll just trip through them in turn. The first one was, and really what permeates his entire sanctions opinion and his Rule 50B opinion, was that we had distorted his claim construction. That's just wrong. Witness every single time, in our opening statement, in our closing argument, in Grimson's testimony, Smith's testimony, Buchholz's testimony, you look at the cited pages. They are absolutely scrupulous about making clear that they understand that the claim was literally construed to require an array of microphones, that they are proceeding under an equivalence, and that it is explained over and over and over again in this case. So he has simply made, and he understood that. He overruled a dozen or more objections on this point with the contemporaneous explanation that this is the function way result test analysis, and he's explaining why he thinks it's an equivalent. He ruled for us three times on this basis. It is an error of law for him to have subsequently changed his mind and concluded that by proceeding on an equivalence theory, we were distorting his rulings. That's number one.
It's an error of law to have changed his mind on a question of fact?
No, it is an error of law to have construed a garden variety doctrine of equivalence case plainly presented with nothing concealed at all.
Which is a fact question.
It is an error of law to, this is my submission to you, it is an error of law to construe a garden variety doctrine of equivalence defense plainly presented as a distortion of the literal claim construction. That's the error of law. Now, he made three subsidiary findings with respect to litigation misconduct, and I think I can address each of them fairly quickly. The first was, he said, well, our demonstration of our device, the stealth station, was an improper effort to invite the jury to make a product-to-product comparison. Now, a couple of things about this. First of all,
I thought it wasn't demonstrated.
It was demonstrated. He ruled three times over Brain Lab's objection that this could be demonstrated under Right Height for the purpose of showing lost profits. They even, in his last ruling, they said, well, we'll stipulate that these products compete with each other. And we've reprinted in our reply brief, I think, his ruling, where he said to Brain Lab's lawyer, are you going to demonstrate your machine? They said yes. He said, well, then I'm going to let them demonstrate their machine with an instruction that the jury, for purposes of determining infringement, is not to make a product-to-product comparison. And he gave that instruction then. He gave that instruction in closing. And interestingly, he gave that instruction he interrupted Mr. Campbell's opening statement, which was making incessant product-to-product comparisons. Twice sustained objections by Medtronic's trial lawyer during their opening statement that they were making product-to-product comparisons, and he interrupted Mr. Campbell and instructed the jury during opening that they were not to do so. So he, after the fact, 5 months after the trial is over, he is castigating Medtronic for showing its device when he had three times ruled that it could be shown. There was not a single reference in the demonstration to their product. There was no objection made during the demonstration. And he specifically allowed it under Right Height. It is an error of law to conclude under that basis that we've engaged in sanctionable conduct.
Mr. Exman, you may be getting to this one, but the one, let's assume now that we agree with you that there was no impropriety in pursuing the doctrine of equivalence theory, but focusing entirely on the incidents of litigation misconduct. The one that frankly gave me the most pause is the FDA submission being converted into, quote, substantial equivalence, doctrine of equivalence.
Okay.
which I think we can all agree is not correct, right? As a legal matter, it is not the same thing to say substantial equivalence between these two products and doctrine equivalence.
Right. I have actually quite a bit to say about this, and it is on my checklist of things.
Okay.
Well, let me go right to it, because I agree that this is, I mean, in terms of something that might raise eyebrows, this is really the only thing, I think, in this case. The only other point that he mentions, which maybe the court doesn't need elucidation about, is the closing argument remarks about prosecution history.
Well, actually, the one that is most troubling was the one in the opening statement.
Okay, well, let me make a couple of points about this. First of all, we never contended that the FDA application and their claim of substantial equivalence under 510K amounted to the same test or established a doctrine of infringement by the doctrine of equivalence, although it wasn't until 3 years after the trial in this court that this court ruled that it clearly involves a 403, 401, you know, prejudice versus probative value issue, but it was in 2008 in the fall of 2008, that this court held that it was not admissible as a categorical matter to prove doctrinal equivalence. But be that as it may, we never argued it. We made clear that that wasn't the test. Let me go through this chronologically. Long before trial, in the summary judgment briefing and in the pretrial conference, it was clear that Brain Lab's theory was they were going to win because they were the innovator, their product was first, and we copied. We put their FDA submission on our exhibit list. It was referenced by Mr. McMahon during his opening statement. And I am not here saying that the reference to doctrinal equivalence in that ungrammatical sentence, our position is, his contention is, that that was a misstatement. It was a misstatement that was not objected to. They didn't request, at the time, they did not request that the jury be instructed. They did not discuss it in their motion for sanctions before Judge Mache. Judge Mache doesn't discuss it in his ruling.
Oh, I interpreted Judge Mache's reference to the FDA application. Now, I understand there are two elements to that. One is an admission of equivalence for purposes of damages versus an admission for purposes of infringement. But Judge Mache refers to the argument made by counsel as deceiving the jury into accepting the statements in the FDA application as an admission of patent infringement, which I took it to mean that that refers to the effort to draw a parallel between substantial equivalence in the FDA application and equivalence under the doctrine of equivalence.
And here's
So that is Judge Mache's characterization.
Absolutely right.
That
and
refers
that,
to this,
that comes yeah, no, that that refers to the rebuttal closing argument. Judge Mache never makes any reference, even a citation, to the opening statement. And I'm going to get to the rebuttal closing argument, but
we're going to run out of time. So
okay. Let me just say this. The FDA statement was introduced into evidence without objection during our cross-examination of Dr. Vilsmeier for the avowed purpose of demonstrating that we were the innovator and they were claiming a right to sell their device because it was substantial equivalent to ours. At closing argument, which is where it's an admission point, comes up, in our opening closing, in our initial closing, we didn't mention the FDA at all. Not one word about the FDA. Mr. Shunk, who was making the closing argument for Brain Lab, mentioned it twice. He opened his closing argument with a reference to the FDA application, and he closed with it. And so on rebuttal, Mr. McMahon got up and said, among many other things, they're talking about the FDA, application, and let's talk about this. And if you look at the reference pages, which are, it's very, very important, I think. This is page 7657 and 7658 of the JA. He says, so counsel has made a big deal about the FDA, and that somehow they innovated. Okay, let's see what happens. And Mr. Shunk objects. Your Honor, this is comparing the devices, not the device to the claims. Mr. McMahon, no, Your Honor. This is the discussion here. This is an admission that was made before the FDA, the court. Go ahead. It was clear that what was being argued was they admitted in their application before the FDA that contrary to their contention that they were the innovator, they were seeking the request for a license because we were.
How does that relate to infringement?
I mean, how does the innovator is relate to infringement at all? Right?
What Judge Mache is saying is, as I understand it, is that this reference to substantial equivalence, which was what the argument was directed to with respect to the FDA submission and repeated on several occasions, substantial equivalence. This is not just in the opening statement, although it's more extreme in the opening statement, but in the closing statement as well, it's substantial equivalence. What I understood Judge Mache's reference to that to mean is that's an effort to make substantial equivalence into an infringement-related issue. Why not?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think several points. One, if the sanctions award, I mean, the first point is there were two objections made during this rebuttal closing. The judge ruled for us and allowed this both times. He either understood or didn't understand at the time that we were making the argument that we were the innovator in contrast to their argument that they were. Now, trials, Judge Bryson, you know from reviewing the records in many of them, trials are not perfect. Mistakes are made. This case was tried for 3 weeks. There was plenty of misstatement on both sides, including their closing argument, in which after the judge made clear that prosecution history estoppel was for the court, not for the jury, they spent pages arguing to the jury that it should limit the claims of Buchholz because there had been a clear waiver or clear disavowal of this, and they should view the jury should view the claims as not permissibly including optical. And we objected. We didn't actually object. We stood up and said, Mr. McMahon said, look, that is crazy. The judge is not going to instruct you that that's for him. I mean, the fact that they said that, the fact that in their opening statement they had to be admonished twice for making product-to-product comparisons doesn't mean that a Section 285 award of millions of dollars of sanctions is appropriate under a standard, as this court said in Forest Labs, that it is necessary in order to prevent a gross injustice. Trials are rough and messy things. And the notion that Medtronic and Brainlab would be sanctioned and publicly is subject to public admonition as having engaged in outrageous litigation misconduct because of a couple of sentences that were either not objected to at the time at opening statement or were objected to and were permitted at closing argument is, to say that there is a chill in the trial bar, even because of what Judge Mache has done after the fact, but what this court might sanction is quite an understatement.
So trials are messy things. And you're saying that this court should overrule a trial judge that's trying to draw a line and say, this much is too much.
Judge Lurie, if Judge Mache drew the line very clearly prior to trial and throughout the trial, the most remarkable thing about this case is, unlike the other cases in which you found litigation misconduct of any sort, there is no fooling, there is no concealing, there is no dissembling. Everything is absolutely out there, and he ruled. Every single instance that he points to for litigation misconduct was either the subject of no objection at the time, or he overruled the objection and agreed and allow us to go on. And it's that that's so concerning. Absolutely. I mean, the role of the trial judge is to be a fair judge and a traffic cop that makes rulings, both beforehand as to whether you can proceed on equivalence theory or show the stealth station, or at the time of trial. And Judge Mache did that. And what is just so exceptional about this case is that 5 months after the trial is over, he came to a conclusion that essentially reversed every judgment and trial ruling that he made during the time of this trial. And that's what's so scary about the prospect of an appellate affirmance.
Okay, let's
move on. Thank you. I very much appreciate it.
Mr. Phillips?
It's always hard to come in second, Mr. Phillips.
Particularly when number one has done as admirable and comprehensive a job as he has in this particular instance. I'm not anxious to belabor any of the points that Mr. Waxman's already made, but I do think it's important to recognize the reason I'm here is because, and it goes directly to your question, Judge Lurie, which is why should we try to unpack precisely what the district judge has done in this context? And it is because the judge has gone the extraordinary step further and imposed sanctions directly against the law firm involved in this particular case, and therefore the reputational injury that is wrought as a consequence of the order here is an extraordinary one.
Saying that applies to the law firm but not the company.
Well, I think it heightens the concerns that this court ought to take into account in evaluating whether or not something's an abuse of discretion.
Issues.
I'm sorry?
Gets into a malpractice argument.
Well, it's beyond a malpractice argument.
In other words, a failure to raise an equivalence issue raises a malpractice question.
Well, it would place you in an extraordinary position if you step back and say to the lawyer, you know, you've made a good faith argument with respect to summary judgment. The district court has denied the other side's motion. And now what is the lawyer supposed to do? Go back to the client and say, I'm sorry, but I've reevaluated it and decided we can't make a good faith argument? I also think that's a reasonable basis on which to ultimately, after the fact, impose sanctions.
Doesn't that and shouldn't that happen at times where the lawyer says to the client, for this, that, and the other reason, you no longer have a case?
I'm sure there are situations where that happens. The place where it seems to me least likely ever to be true would be in the context of the doctrine of equivalence, which is about as squishy a set of requirements as exists out there. And particularly, as Mr. Waxman pointed out, you know, if you look at the function and the result, there's no question that they can be. You know, there was no issue about their equivalence. It's only with respect to the way element of it,
which is usually the issue.
To be sure, but the point is if you already have two-thirds of the doctrine of equivalence ultimately uncontested, and the only question is whether or not you can make a good faith argument, and again, you lay it all out. I mean, there is no dissembling. There is no concealment here. It was all put forward in the summary judgment papers to the district court.
I take it that your position is that if we disagree with Judge Mache as to the question of whether this should have gone beyond summary judgment, this case is over with respect to your client because of the 1927 does not reach.
Right. I think that's clear.
The misconduct.
I think that's clear, and I suppose you could make an argument that somehow the inherent powers doctrine is out there, but it seems to me 1927 does the work here, and therefore there is no role for the inherent powers argument to be applied.
Right.
Clearly, there would be no basis for a $4 million award without the multiplicity argument. I mean, there's no colorable argument with respect to that. The only way you can get to that kind of an award, even against Medtronic, obviously, is through the exceptional circumstances finding.
Right.
I don't think there's any question about that. Now, that said, I have to be honest with you, Judge Bryson, the findings of misconduct continue to serve as a significant black mark on my client's reputation, and I think it's worth the court taking a very hard look at each of those instances of misconduct because, candidly, I don't think they withstand serious scrutiny. And I understand the district judge is closer to it, and he has that advantage. But the truth is, we're talking about a district judge who, at the end of the trial, complimented the lawyers in this case for their professionalism and for the efficiency with which they handled this matter. So at least in terms of how the case proceeded, there was no question in his mind about the legitimacy of what the lawyers had done here. It's only in the retrospect, in post hoc hindsight evaluation, that the court then suddenly comes around and concludes, I should never have allowed this case to go forward. Well, that's fine. And he did the right thing. He granted JMOL after the jury verdict, and that's fine. But the basis for then going forward and not only imposing sanctions on the client, but the lawyers is frankly totally beyond the pale when the basis for those sanctions at least once you get past the summary judgment ruling, which I think ultimately is indefensible, is product-to-product comparisons, where it was absolutely clear that that was done for lost profits, multiple instructions to the jury. It may well be that Judge Mach is right, that the jury still got confused. I understand how that could happen and that they may have viewed it that way. Or it may be that there are 100 other reasons why the jury ended up reaching the conclusion.
Or that he thought that the counsel went too far in pointing to equivalency of product to product and confusing the jury. And this is really where perhaps if I read every word of the transcript, it might be a little bit clearer. But what is your perception as to what, in fact, concerned this judge the most? The fact that the jury, by treading this very fine line between substantial equivalence and the doctrine of equivalence, was deliberately misled into reaching a conclusion that the facts didn't support?
I think what ultimately drove the analysis, because I think all of the findings of misconduct really are subsidiary to what ultimately was the primary concern to Judge Mach, which was the whole notion that after his claim construction, the effort to evaluate to put forward a doctrine of equivalence argument was in some sense re-arguing the literal infringement theory, and that's ultimately what drove him to say, I think there's a problem here and one that needs to be corrected by way of sanctions. I think he's wrong about that. I think it's clear that the doctrine of equivalence argument that was in here was offered in good faith, put before him, and if he should have granted summary judgment, that's fine, but he chose not to do so, and what you expect after that follows. So when you get down to these specific elements of alleged misconduct, I frankly think each of them really is quite trivial in the scheme of things. It may well be that the jury was misled, but there's no evidence that we perpetrated that effort to mislead. Indeed, we are the ones who said specifically, Your Honor, you should instruct the jury that this is only with respect to lost profits. That came from us.
Yeah, but not to beat a dead horse, and this horse is probably close to death anyway. But
the client.
But this whole business, I have to say that I kind of gagged on the substantial equivalence, doctrine of equivalence line.
And
it comes back. It's a theme that I can easily see how a jury led to that conclusion could say, you know what, look at this FDA statement. So they admitted that this was equivalent.
I can understand how the jury may have gotten that confusion.
Right.
What I can't say is, in light of this record, that that was somehow our intention. First of all, again, the opening statement. I mean, look, the language substantial equivalence and doctrine of equivalence spelled differently is a complicated line to try to draw. But we had a very legitimate reason to put forward the FDA's determination that they were substantially equivalent. The other side was making a pitch that they were the innovator. And we were making a pitch that we were the innovator. We were the ones who came up with it. And the best evidence of it was that the FDA had said, theirs is substantially equivalent to ours. But that's
equivalence, equivalent, but not equivalence to the patent claims.
Right.
But that's not a problem.
But again, that assumes somehow the lawyers were trying to take advantage of something.
I listened to that section of which was provided to it just for exactly this reason, to see if it sounded like a slip of the tongue. And for what it's worth, I came away with the impression that it was intentional. It didn't sound like a slip of the tongue.
But again, even if you accept that, Judge Bryson, first of all, it's not the item that the district judge adopted. So it's not as though that's a finding that was not a slip of the tongue to which you have to defer. The only one he points to is the reference to admission, which is only in the rebuttal portion at the back end.
I think those elements are intertwined as I read the district court's opinion. But
the district judge is very explicit about referring to admission, and admission only takes place there. And there are two references, the two different pages, it's 7657 and 7658. And the first one is absolutely crystal that all they're talking about is an admission that our product came first. They are admitting that our product came first. He relies on the second one, taken slightly out of context, where he says this is an admission, where he says that you could potentially read that a different way. But it's pretty clear to me that throughout, if you read this fairly, that counsel was simply making the argument that this is an admission, that they are equivalent, we were first, and therefore that's a perfectly permissible way to go. And again, put it in the context of it's responding to an argument that has been made by the other side. This is not, you know, Judge Bryson, part of some master plan to sort of throw this theme in. It, you know, there are two sporadic references to it, one at the very beginning in the opening and one in the rebuttal in the closing. Well, and nothing else that the lawyers do remotely reflects some effort to make
The one that in the closing that seemed to me to tie back into the opening more than any of the admission references was the reference to substantial equivalence. That is, that bears directly on what we're doing here today, i.e. infringement.
Well, except that what we're doing here today is evaluating every aspect of the case. In this context, again, he's talking, this is a rebuttal to an argument that was made by the other side that we are the innovators. And he's trying to debunk that notion and saying, no, this is a pioneer patent. We were the innovators. We're the ones who should be regarded as the good guys in this context. And he's trying to make that argument, again, recognizing, you know, that this is not something where the judge seemed to misunderstand what we were trying to accomplish there, or that he had any problem with it. It's only 6 months after the fact when he comes in. And then, of course, the final point is the prosecution history estoppel, which I frankly don't think there's much to say, and I don't even see the other side as having said much about that. I would like to end with the same point that my brother Waxman did, which is it is incredibly important for this court to recognize the extraordinary chill that this ruling has had and will have in terms of how lawyers are supposed to respond when they, in fact, succeed in making reasonable arguments and then expose themselves after the fact to what I regard as an extraordinary award and one that I hope this court will reverse.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Campbell, and would you enlarge Mr. Campbell's time? I suppose double it. Or have, I guess it's, we may not need it all, but
I don't know how much I'll need, Your Honor.
Please
but I'm
proceed.
Happy to have whatever you want to give me.
Mr. Campbell, what do you think was the focus? Why did this experienced trial judge change his mind from having complimented counsel at the end of trial to some months later vigorously chastising your opposition?
Well, I think that the fact that he complimented trial at the end of the trial doesn't, or trial counsel at the end of the trial doesn't mean that much. I've been to many trials. I'm sure, sat through many trials, as have your honors. That is a conventional thing that almost every judge does at the end of almost every trial, regardless of what happens.
You think it's common courtesy?
Yes, it is. You know, it just happens. You're in front of your clients. A lot has gone on. The jury has just come back. That's generally what a judge says.
But your problem is that there was a jury verdict, and there was a denial of JMOL, and a lot went on here in their favor.
Yes, you're right.
He just turned a corner.
No, he didn't. Well, I mean, I think what happened is the judge realized that these weren't isolated incidences, which is what it seemed like at the beginning. Most of the times when there was an objection from us, the judge overruled it, but he didn't strictly overrule it. He overruled it because, for example, trial counsel would say, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to make the comparison. And then the next thing he goes to is the page right out of the FDA submission, which says, comparing the devices, substantial equivalent. So even
I don't want to cut you off as you're outlining your general approach, but just for whatever it's worth, my own sense of this, the reason I focus so much on this substantial equivalence, which you've turned to, is because I frankly have looked at all of the various points that the judge and you in your brief have alluded to, and I'm having a hard time finding anything else that I can point to and say, wow, now there's a problem.
Aside from the substantial
equivalence? Aside from the substantial equivalence. And so in talking about the elements that you think justify what the judge did in this case, try to help me see what is so horrific about each of the things that you complain about that the judge, where you think the judge was justified in saying, this warrants the exceptional case treatment and 1927 sanctions against the firm.
Yes. First, I want to point out, we're doing this 4 years after the trial. You know, the judge, of course, sat through the trial. The judge sat through you know, understood the discovery. He understood claim construction, everything else, 13 days of trial. He was the one best able to look at this as it happened, not on a cold record. But I think what happened, and the judge realized towards the end of trial, is that these weren't isolated incidents. It wasn't just substantial equivalence. It wasn't just this distortion of the claim construction. It wasn't just the comparison of the devices. They all came together, as the judge said, to form a common strategy. And that's how they got to the jury. It started with the doctrine of equivalence argument. And I know they say that it's a doctrine of the garden variety doctrine of equivalence argument, right? But it's not. If you want to get to the footnote, what their footnote says in their brief is that a claim will be to a fastener, okay? And the judge says, well, what fastener means is button or zipper. What it means is zipper. Then what you do is you combine or you compare a button to a zipper, right? That's the doctrine of equivalence. That's not what they did. The judge said that the array of, the array means was an array of microphones. The reference means was an array of microphones. That wasn't their comparison. They weren't comparing something to an array of microphones or comparing, passive optical to active acoustic. What they did is they got rid of that reference means. They got rid of the microphones, and they just said it's sensors. They said it's exactly what they lost on. And if you see, if you go through all the exhibits they used, they got rid of the microphone array, and they compared everything to sensors. So this wasn't the button versus zipper. This is button back to fastener. So it was an improper doctrine of equivalence analysis. And that's why the judge was upset, because he issued his ruling. He determined what the doctrine of equivalence meant. I mean, he determined what the claim construction meant. And they disregarded that. They disregarded that from the very first witness.
But isn't that what advocates do? They were presenting a theory that, no, it doesn't really matter particularly what scientific procedure is used to achieve this result, that whether you use microphones or sensors, whatever. That was their argument. Your argument was otherwise. The jury went one way, the judge went the other, and we upheld the judge.
Mm-hmm.
But there's at some stage, obviously, the trial judge thought that they went too far in the argument, and where I am having the trouble is deciding where the argument loses its legitimacy. We, as you know, each side puts its argument forward in the strongest possible terms.
Right.
And again, in the heat of trial, how does one know? Certainly, counsel is not looking to blight their reputation with having gone too far and having it publicized.
Well, I agree with that.
And all the rest of it. Where did they go so far that these serious sanctions were warranted?
I think what Judge Mage said is they went too far overall, if nothing else. I mean, some of these things were egregious, like the FDA submission and things like that, some of the comparisons. But where the judge said is this was a strategy. He determined that these weren't all isolated instances that happened.
It was a strategy. Everyone has a strategy. Where did that strategy go too far?
Where the strategy went too far is they took this from being a case about a patent and Brain Labs device to being about something wholly different. Whether Brain Labs device was the same as the Medtronic device, the Stealth Station, and if so, the way they used the comparisons, the way they used the FDA equivalence argument, that's all the jury had to do.
You said the same as. They argued it was equivalent. They lost on the same as.
Excuse me?
They argued it was equivalent.
They argued it wasn't equivalent to the patent. It wasn't equivalent to the claim, which is what we all know you have to do in a patent case. You look at the defendant's device and you compare it to the claim and determine whether it's equivalent to the claim. That's not what they did. And I don't think, to be honest, Judge Mache realized at the very beginning what they were doing.
What did they compare it to, their own non-patented product?
They compared it to their own product. Well, first they represented to the judge that their product, they were going to show that their product was covered by the claims. And then the judge was a little more comfortable letting the jury see that. Well, we know now that they knew that that was a misstatement at the very time, because now they admit that they know that their product wasn't covered. So, you know, they made this direct misstatement to the judge so they could build this comparison. And then they brought in the FDA statement which made it so that they could just say, look, members of the jury, substantial equivalence, doctrine of equivalence, it's the same thing. You don't even have to look at the patent. You compare our devices, and sit, because under the doctrine of equivalence analysis we've used,
no,
we've shown you...
they didn't say that. You're saying that, right?
Well, no, that's the gist of it. But they did say...
What you're saying is what the jury understood.
Exactly, and what the judge said that the jury understood. The judge who was there at the time, that's what he took away from this. That's what you're going to understand. All these references to substantial equivalence are, is comparing the devices. Because they happened throughout the case. It wasn't just one isolated incident. You know, first he mentions it in the opening argument. Of course, you know, they're the plaintiffs. They go first. They bring that up before BrainLab even says a word. They bring up the FDA submission. They talk about substantial equivalence several times. And then Mr. McMahon says, that's doctrine of equivalence, or doctrine of equivalent, as it came out.
We're hearing from the other side the obvious reputational impact here, the impairment of the obligation of zealous advocacy, sending a wrong message. You're in a law firm. Aren't you attempting to pollute the pond you live in?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I'm not advocating that you can't make a doctrine of equivalence argument. You can. We all do. We should. But you have to make the right comparison. You compare the device to the claims as construed by the judge. That's not what they did. Mr. McMahon is a wonderful trial lawyer, one of the best I've ever seen. I've litigated against him. He's great. But they went too far. And they went too far, we believe, because they knew, fully well aware, at claim construction, they didn't have a case. And that's exactly what Judge Meeks said.
How do you define too far? If we were to define for you and affirm, is there a bright line that we should adopt?
Of course not. There is no bright line. That's why the standard set here is clear error. You know, we look to whether the judge
clearly
erred.
Clear error or abuse of discretion?
What?
Clear error or abuse of discretion?
Well, they come down to the same thing. Abuse of discretion, the first thing you look at is whether there's clear error, right? So it is clear error or abuse of discretion. It comes down to the same thing, meaning is what the judge said plausible?
If the allegations of litigation misconduct, such as the product-to-product comparison and the reference to the FDA equivalence, had not occurred, but instead counsel had and the witnesses had scrupulously referred to the array of microphones instead of the sensors each time, would it have been appropriate, in your view, for the plaintiffs to have taken the case to verdict?
No, because as the judge found, from the beginning, they had full awareness their case was without merit. I mean, if they could have made that comparison, sure.
Well, why exactly was their case without merit?
Well, you know, they talk about summary judgment and that the judge had this all at summary judgment. Well, what the judge had were conclusory opinions from their expert and a representation from counsel that, oh, sure, Your Honor, there's loads of factual questions.
Wait a minute. I mean, an affidavit in opposition to summary judgment typically doesn't say there's loads of evidence and we'll tell you about it later. Mm-hmm. They presented
but what they evidence. Did. What they did is they submitted conclusory affidavits from their experts, conclusory affidavits which said, oh, these are equivalent. They said they relied on those to think that they had a good faith basis. Well, they, of course, had more access to their experts than we did, and just in simple cross-examination at trial, the experts admitted that there was very little basis. For example, Halbrand. Halbrand, they said that the reason that Halbrand was infringed was because it stopped every 20th of a second, looked at this thing called a Mayfield reference star, recalculated everything. Okay, and it always had to find it first. Well, you know, I cross-examined Dr. Halbrand, and I asked him, where is that in the code? You know, you spent thousands of hours looking at the code. Where is it? He admitted it's not in there. He did not know anywhere where it could be found. So the very fundamental basis of their infringement opinion, which you would have thought they'd have asked their expert about, wasn't even in the code. There was no evidence whatsoever. And the same thing happened with Buholz and Roberts. Because when we t- talked to their expert on the stand. When we cross-examined them, we asked again about the way, because this is a case about doctrine of equivalence, about the way. How do they function? They function the same way. He readily admitted in several different times that no, they don't function the same way. They're opposites, in fact.
So I hear you telling us that the Brain Lab put on a superb defense, but they lost before the jury.
Yes.
Now, what we need to understand is whether the reason they lost was attributable to the jury's weighing of the facts and trying to figure it out, trying to do their best and come out right, or something so egregious that it needs to be punished.
Exactly. And that's why, again, we go to clear error. That's the standard here. The judge was there. The judge determined that the jury went astray simply because of the representations that were made. They went astray because of this considered tactic of trying to make the comparison between the devices and then using the...
When you say the representations that were made, I mean, the representations in the at the summary judgment stage? No.
No, no, no. I'm saying... The jury wasn't at the summary judgment stage. Opening argument from the very beginning compared the devices and said substantial equivalence, right? Doctrinal equivalence. So from the very beginning, the comparison wasn't about the claims. It was about the two products. And the FDA submission made it very easy to do that. And then once they got up and they convinced the judge that they were going to prove that their device is covered by the claims, even though they knew it wasn't, that allowed the judge and convinced the judge to show their device. And when we showed both devices a couple days apart, they're going to look very similar. Even though neither of them infringed the claims, they looked so similar, and then they used the FDA submission to make the case not about patent infringement anymore.
I have a feeling we're hearing some advocacy as well. The judge agreed to let the trial go forward, but you tell us, no, they convinced the judge of this or that, in which case perhaps the judge should not have permitted the trial to go forward.
Well, I think he's said several times in his opinion that he should not have let the trial go forward.
But
he said he should have granted summary judgment. He should have stopped in a number of places along the way. But again, I think it's clear that the judge didn't understand the grand scheme. He called it a tactic. He said it was an intentional scheme to try to deliberately mislead the jury.
And he
was misled as well.
Tell us again, as specifically as you can, what particularly was misleading.
Okay. Again, all of the isolated incidents we're looking at just seem to be, you know, somewhere spaced amongst a 13-day trial, right? But when you look at them together, what is it? You know, it's this grand scheme to try to make a comparison which is not the patent claims. It's not comparing the Brain Lab device to the patent claims. It's comparing the two devices together and using the FDA submission to say, ah.
Well, it sounds like where you're going in response to Judge Newman's question is to say that the theme that integrates all of these various strands is the product-to-product comparison. Is that a fair characterization
yes,
of where you are?
Well, without question. I mean, it is that product comparison they use to say, you just compare the products, you don't do this infringement thing at all. But the way that they were able to get to that first was by distorting the claim construction and saying that it's really sensors, radiation. Sensors and radiation. If there's sensors, if there's radiation, it infringes. And that's what they said over and over and over. That's what Dr. Smith said. That's what Dr. Buchholz said. That's what their experts said. And we showed you in the brief, they've got these wonderful exhibits which show alternate tracking units and what the claims are supposed to mean. Their expert, Dr. Grimson, says, this is what I interpret the court's claim construction to mean. You don't see a array of microphones on there. You see sensors. You see the exact claim construction they lost on, which is, again, what Judge Mage said.
One of the problems you have is not that each of the errors is so significant in and of themselves, because maybe they're not. Product-to-product comparison may be a ground of reversal, but hardly sanction. And even the FDA equivalence point, ground for reversal, if that's the way it went, but sanctions. So your point, I guess, is that it's the totality in light of the claim construction.
Well, without question, it's the totality, and that's what Judge said. But the Judge Mage said. But I think also some of those individually are enough for sanctions. But you take them all together, And McDermott, Will, and Emery are good trial lawyers. They've done this before. You have to wonder, how did they make all these errors if they weren't intentional?
If we were to conclude that the judge was incorrect with respect to saying that the case should not have gone beyond summary judgment, they should not have pursued this case to trial, but correct with respect to individual points as to litigation misconduct, would this case under the 1927 and inherent authority rationale against McDermott, Will, and Emery fail?
No, I don't think so.
Why not? Since 1927 requires
multiplicity right.
of
you know, basically what
proceedings.
What the argument for McDermott, Will, and Emery is, and the way they put it basically is, if a lawyer can get by summary judgment, they can do whatever they want. They have free reign. That's their argument. That's not true. 1927 tries to get at that, but inherency, the inherent powers of the court, gets at that more than anything. If they thought, and if we want to have a rule that once you get by summary judgment, you're free to say whatever you want, you're free to make up anything, you're free to, you know, anything goes mentality, which
are
is what the judge said they
have. Are this is what they're telling us?
Yes. If you read the brief, they're advocating a rule that once you get past summary judgment, anything goes. You're free to make any argument you want, no matter how frivolous, no matter how vexatious, no matter how misleading and improper. Because they say 1927 can't get to that. Well, if it doesn't...
Did I find that in their brief?
I think that's the thrust of it, Your Honor. I'm not quoting them, of course, per se, but that's what they say. That's what they argue, is that once they get past summary judgment, nothing else mattered. And in fact, I believe there, we quote in our brief one of the statements about no matter how frivolous it is, even if Medtronic's equivalence arguments were especially frivolous, at most, McDermott's decision to oppose summary judgment put the court to the task of saying so. So what they're saying
is... That means that they're free to make a frivolous argument?
They're free to make a frivolous argument as long as they get by summary judgment. Well, if 1927 isn't, quote, up to the task of sanctioning that, that's what the court's inherent powers are for. So that's where this comes in, if nothing else, because we know it can't be true. You know, as lawyers, we know that once we get past summary judgment, we're not free to make whatever misleading, frivolous argument we want. We are bound by all sorts of ethical considerations to the court as officers of the court. And that's where the inherent powers of the court come in. If 1927 isn't up to the task because they didn't essentially extend anything, cause multiplicity in litigation, that's what the inherent powers are for. So, no, I don't think that gets McDermott, Will, and Emery off the hook just because the court could have granted summary judgment. In fact, said he should have granted summary judgment if he had understood everything about the case that he learned after the trial.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
Mr. Waxman, let's try
four,
and stick
to
the time.
I have four brief points. First, with respect to the FDA point that Judge Bryson has expressed concern about, among many, one thing I didn't mention is, even after this rebuttal closing, however it was or wasn't interpreted, at no point did they ever request an instruction to the jury that you've heard about this FDA thing, it's in evidence, but I caution you to do X, Y, and Z. They requested and received, we requested and received an instruction on product-to-product comparison first during their opening statement. Second, at the time we demonstrated our machine with the court's permission, and third, at closing. Even if you find fault, and Judge Bryson, I know I can see how concerned you are about this reference. We're talking, the question here is whether there is clear and convincing evidence that that statement or those two statements taken together, that there is clear and convincing evidence that they represent the kind of gross injustice that in hindsight, contrary to everything the court did or didn't do at the time, warrants a scarlet letter of sanctionable conduct. And even if you thought that it did, This court made clear in Rambis and elsewhere that 285 sanctions that are based on litigation misconduct alone have to be targeted at whatever the precise misconduct is, not some huge award that relates to everything that was done after summary judgment, including our successful defeating of their cross claims and their request for travel costs and expert. I mean, if nothing else shows the abuse of discretion in this case, it's the judge's cavalier rejection of the inarguable points as to which they weren't entitled to fees. Now, they keep wrapping this FDA point into product-to-product comparison. I made the point about how we respected the instruction at the instance of their opening statement. You go to page 33, note 6 of their brief, where they list out all the instances in which we supposedly constantly urge the jury to make this. And look at our treatment of it on reply brief, page 21, note 11. It's not there. We did not encourage the jury to make repeated product-to-product comparisons. It's an outrageous statement to have said that we did so. Now, my third point is with respect to the doctrine of equivalence. Number one, our doctrine of equivalence argument was based not only on our own expert testimony, which was in all material respects fully disclosed in the summary judgment papers and affidavits, and revealingly, they make no, their brief doesn't even cite to any of the summary judgment papers and the expert reports and the places in which we laid all of this out. They don't have a single example of an instance in which our experts testified differently on equivalence. Our doctrine of equivalence argument was utterly directed at the claims. It was based in part on the evidence of their own witnesses. Their expert testified, and we explain this at page 31 of our blue brief, their expert testified that he himself in his own patent application had discussed the equivalent of optical and sonic sensors in a very similar device. The president of their company acknowledged that after he had decided to proceed with passive optical technology, they tried to get a license from Surgical Navigation Technologies, the little company that had the Buchholz patent and is the plaintiff in this case. So our doctrine of equivalence argument wasn't just based on our expert testimony. It was also based on admissions of them. Now, with respect to our expert, if you want to put the lie to the notion that we were obscuring the court's claim construction, which is repeated in their brief over and over again, not with reference to Dr. Grimson's testimony, but on page 69 of their brief, they say, and we've heard it again today, Medtronic's expert, Dr. Grimson, even testified that the claim term in dispute reference means was a, quote, sensor for detecting radiation, despite it being construed as an array of microphones, with a cite to the record. Cite to the record is to the judge's opinion, making that conclusion, the actual pages where this occurred. And I beg the court to read these pages, is 6576, 6578 of the record, where Dr. Grimson is asked, question, now did you take into account and apply the court's instructions with respect to referencing? Answer, absolutely. The court said that reference means here was an array of microphones. Okay, so how do you find that met? There are cameras. He said, answer, I found this under the doctrine of equivalence. Mr. Campbell, objection. This is a representation from what they want the claim to mean. It's not the claim at all. The court, well, it's a representation of his testimony as I understand its purpose. Is that correct? Answer, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. The court, all right. He then proceeds to the very exhibits, 1208 and 1209, that Brain Lab finds so objectionable in this case, and explains with respect to 1208, which demonstrates sound waves. So this is a block diagram of a reference. I'm going to use the word tracking unit, because to me, that's in essence what this is doing. Mr. Campbell, objection. He's replacing the court's definition of reference. He said he replaced reference means with tracking unit. That's obviously not correct because the court has given it a proper construction, which is not tracking unit. The court. He's testified to his opinion that it's the same thing, as I understand the testimony. Is that correct? Answer, thank you, Your Honor. The witness, yes, it is, sir. The court, all right. Question, and that was the court's construction, was it not? An array of microphones. Answer, yes, it was. Please explain your opinion. Answer, the way here is basically triangulation. He then goes on and explains it and says, if I may, Your Honor, I apologize if I used tracking unit incorrectly. It was simply my term for what I thought of this as. But the court, we understand your testimony, sir. Go ahead. And it goes on and on in this vein along those lines. And that's the context in which this doctrinal equivalent argument was made.
Okay, now, finally, one final word.
My one final word is respect to the reference to Dr. Taylor's testimony about the Heilbrun patents, which, you know, they demonstrated in cross-examination at trial that it doesn't find the Mayfield reference star first. Well, okay. This is an apparatus claim, as we pointed out in our briefing and on the legal points. There is no particular requirement that it be found first, and their own product information, which we introduced at trial with respect to this one disputed element as to the Heilbrun claims, specifically says, and I'm quoting from their material, that the Mayfield reference star, quote, establishes the three-dimensional coordinate system. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all. The case is taken under submission. Thank you, Mr. Waxman, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Your Honor.